Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my guest is Jennifer Egan. You know, I've been reading Jennifer's work since before I had a show. I can't pretend to you that she's new to me or a surprise to me. I've always loved it. One morning, I was woken by my wonderful, brilliant critic friend, Pauline Kael. Pauline wrote weekly for The New Yorker eventually, and she read a story called Why China. And she said, Michael, you have to read this. This is a first-rate story, and it was a terrific story. But since that time, she has written, well, a novel, The Invisible Circus, came first, and then the book of stories called Emerald City, and then The Keep, and then the magnificent Pulitzer Prize-winning A Visit from the Goon Squad, and now a novel called Manhattan Beach. And I thought we should do something special, because Jennifer Egan's mode of revelation is extremely surprising and complex, and I decided that we should only talk about plot in Manhattan Beach up to around the first two chapters, because I really want to talk about how things are hidden more than how they're revealed. And I think it makes for very exciting reading. I think the first thing to be known is that this book takes place where? In the 1930s, right?
1934 and then 1942.
Right. And what made you choose that period of New York life?
I didn't know exactly what drew me to it initially, but I had been thinking about it since about 2004, and I think it really probably dates to 9/11, when New York basically became a war zone overnight, and there was a strong military presence, very heavy police presence. You couldn't go below Canal Street. There was a sense of emergency everywhere. And I think it was so shocking to see that happen. I mean, that's just not something Americans are used to. And I think it led me naturally to wonder what New York was like during the Second World War. And I think probably the other component of it, which was in a way was explicit, it got me thinking about the trajectory of American global power. And 9/11 clearly was an event in that trajectory. I think the ramifications of that event we're still seeing now. So I think those were the kind of intellectual thoughts. And then viscerally, which is often what it really comes down to for me, I just had a kind of longing to be there. And especially to use the noir in some way to get at that kind of the urbanness of that war experience in New York.
So you mention a flossy flirt doll. And one of the first things we see the leading character, Anna, doing is we know from her interior that two Christmases ago, when Flossie Flirt made the scene, that Anna did not want anything more than a Flossie Flirt doll. So much so, the description is, that her desire stuck inside her and now is still there. Flossie Flirt is no longer played with by the little girl who Anna visits in the first chapter. Oh, take it, she says. I don't play with it. And a whole battalion of untrue reasons proceed. I'm too old for dolls, is one of them. She's nine. The little friend is eight. The woman who is called their nurse, says, "Take it, dear," almost violently. They have so many toys, they don't know what to do with them. They never play with them. And Anna says, "Oh, I only wanted to see it. I have a bigger one at home. I just wanted to see what the little one looks like." Really, she still wants nothing more. It's brought back her yearning, her desire. But the noir you're talking about requires that all these characters speak with forked tongue, yeah?
Yes, that's actually an interesting point, because I wondered before as I was starting it, I thought, this is an interesting mix of stuff, because I'm really interested in the noir, and yet there is certainly a domestic component to this story. How are those going to fit together? But I think you've found the link, which is that whether we're in the domestic realm or the realm of, you know, organized crime, the waterfront, you know, all the different milieus in which the book takes place, there is a fair amount of deception going on everywhere. And in fact, in Why China, the story you alluded to, I had never thought about this, but there's a similar setup in the sense that two men meet, they have met before, one of them knows it, and the other one doesn't. So it's actually quite similar.
This story is a root story for you. I think when you were writing, it was the place you discovered secrecy and how perhaps to use it or ignore it, that it was yours, that it was your choice in Manhattan Beach. The mother says, "I hope next time you come, you'll bring your little sister. I so want to meet her." And Anna says, "Oh, I will." Well, this little sister is never going to meet. She is brain damaged. And they keep this as a secret. The father has a saying, "Do not give up a fact unless you're forced to. Don't tell the truth unless it's being forced out of you." So, yes, this book is full of noir and organized crime. And the first time Anna remembers being punished, do you remember what it was?
Yes, swearing and repeating the swear words that she heard on the docks.
Right, in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. And what's so interesting to me, Jennifer, is that that Brooklyn Navy Yard, which anyone who grew up in Brooklyn knew and visited, but that Brooklyn Navy Yard is even a facet in the portrait of a lady, Henry James, Madame Merle. Her secret life comes from the Brooklyn Navy Yard. And people who learn to speak inelegant English learn it there from the sailors. I mean, it's such...
I remember that. I reread that book recently, and I was so surprised. But, you know, one thing that you get at that's important is this idea of keeping secrets. I mean, Anna and her father have a kind of secret life in a way, which involves her going with him to do his work, which is essentially enabling a corrupt union through delivering and receiving bribes. And her father, in a way, involves her in this without ever thinking about the repercussions. But when they come back from this trip to the beach, where they meet the other little girl and the scene that you're describing goes on, they've come to meet a guy named Dexter Stiles, who is, we have a sense that Anna's father's afraid of him. And when they get back to Anna and her father's apartment, someone mentions Dexter Stiles' name, and Anna basically conceals the fact that they have just been there visiting him. And her father is very taken aback by that. And he notices that she is deceptive, and he decides not to bring her with him to work anymore. But in a certain sense, he's made her that way by maintaining this deception with her that the younger sister is just ill that day and that that's why she can't come, that that's why Anna's mother isn't there. So there's a sort of paradox. You know, he has groomed her to keep secrets.
I'm going to be asking Jennifer Egan to read from the first chapter of Manhattan Beach.
Okay, so this is as Anna and her father are driving back after the visit to Dexter Stiles. During that visit, which happens in the winter, Anna takes off her shoes and goes into the freezing cold ocean. She wades in, and to her horror, her father and Dexter Stiles come onto the beach at that moment and see her, and she can tell that her father is very unhappy with this rather odd act, which caught the attention of Dexter Stiles. So now they're riding home. "Why the bare feet, Toots?" he asked, as she'd known he would. "To feel the water. That's something little girls do. Tabitha is 8, and she didn't. She'd better sense. Mr. Stiles liked that I did." "You've no idea what Mr. Stiles thought." "I have. He talked to me when you couldn't hear." "I noticed that," he said, glancing at her. "What did he say?" Her mind reached back to the sand, the cold, the ache in her feet, and the man beside her, curious. All of it fused now with her longing for that flossy flirt. "He said I was strong," she said, a lump tightening her voice. Her eyes blurred. "And so you are, Toots," he said, kissing the top of her head. "Anyone can see that."
And you see, what we know about this very opening section of Manhattan Beach is that Anna has in fact said to Dexter Stiles that it hurts when you stand in the cold water without your shoes on, but only for a moment, and then you don't feel it at all. And Dexter Stiles says to her, "That's like life." And we've been given this clue to what will be life in its relation to pain. And then somehow or other, Anna knows not to tell her father about that exchange. Because Dexter and her father have gone off to a greenhouse and they've gotten tomatoes that grow in the greenhouse in the winter. So he's going to bring home a surprise. But even that surprise is surrounded by darkness. The mother said, "Where did you get these tomatoes?" And the little girl says, rushes in to rescue her father, "One of his union friends has a greenhouse." That's not, in fact, the case. It's just a rescue. And you see, once you start to read this book truly, you discover that the book is a whole net, like Russian dolls, of concealing alignments. And it gets very exciting because at first it seems so casual, this lying and concealing. And then it becomes the mechanism by which the book is built. Now, how did you make that bridge?
I actually come to it pretty instinctively. I write a first draft by hand. I often don't really know what's coming. And in fact, sometimes all I will know is it had better not be anything I can think of, because the things I can think of are not interesting enough. I'm looking for things I can't think of. So it happens instinctively. Of course, once I have a draft, and in this case, we're talking about 1,400 handwritten pages, and I type it and I read it, then I start to have a sense of the architecture or the mechanism, and then I shape it very, very carefully. But the initial, I feel like oddly, the best intricacy for me has a kind of natural, organic form to it that I can only get to by writing blindly and fairly instinctively and impulsively.
Anna in the nursery, she's no longer a rich girl. She once thought she might be. Her father was a union manager, but now the union owns their car, lends the car to them. The natural expectation, maybe I'm revealing too much of myself here, is that when you go into a room full of toys that you've wanted desperately, and you're told that the children don't play with those toys, you don't want it to be known how desperate you are in wanting it, my impulse is to steal that doll. And the theft that goes on, the secret thefts that go on, enter the novel practically by the third page. And this is going to be everyone's modus operandi. You see, we're reading a thoroughly enjoyable, almost a creamy writing style. And we learn about Dexter Stiles, what a name, that he has nightclubs and that he has nothing to do with the union. And he seems like an exotic figure, but in fact, he's a criminal figure. And the book is going to be making that distinction between the exotic and the criminal and locating it historically because, of course, we have a nation that underwent prohibition. So this book really is like bright red tomatoes in winter. You know, it's a surprise. You are constantly discovering that you can grow what you need in a glass house, that there are all sorts of ways of stacking secrets and making alternatives.
Well, a couple of thoughts about that. I mean, one thing that was so interesting to me, you know, there was the minute you scratched the surface of the waterfront, and I knew pretty early that this was going to be a book about that, you immediately hit crime. Prohibition had an amazing impact on Prohibition organized crime, really. You know, gangsters were welcome in the course of polite society. So that left the gangster in a kind of interesting state culturally. And it was really fun to explore that. You raise the question of why Anna doesn't take the doll, which is very interesting. These people are all thieves in a certain way, but they're all tremendously proud. And it's pride that keeps her from taking the doll. Her father is unbelievably proud. So is Dexter Stiles. They've engaged in these criminal ways of life as a way to get upward mobility. And from their point of view, they're way above stealing anything from anyone else in that way. The theft is almost abstract in their lives. What they want is to be you know, respectable members of a society, you know, and to be taken seriously. And in Dexter Stiles' case, he is really eager to have genuine legitimacy. He has some of the trappings of it because he owns a bunch of nightclubs and he's well known and his name is in the papers and he's married a kind of blue-blooded banker's daughter. And he, you know, he's very close to legitimacy, or so it seems. But that last that last few percentage points of difference turn out to be pretty important.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Jennifer Egan. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm. I'm talking with Jennifer Egan about her latest book, Manhattan Beach, a thriller of a historical novel at the dawn of the transformation of women's roles in the American workforce. And that's a whole subject, too. At first, when we enter this book, we see two men and otherwise nothing but women. And they've had adventures. A sister has had an adventure in Cuba. There's been a lot of sexual dexterity that lies under the surface in this book. And I guess what I'm saying is that that space between your first draft, done so laboriously, and your orchestration of the architecture, you've managed somehow to write the whole book in the first 30 or 40 pages. It's just that the reader has to read the rest to see how deeply concealed these bodies are.
Well, one thing I often think about is that, you know, ideally, the early pages of a book are sort of like laying a complicated place setting. You know, you have the forks, the knives, you know, several plates. And in a certain sense, you know, everything that you need should be there. And you certainly should use everything that you've laid out. Since I do write so blindly, and sometimes I go, you know, really off the rails partway through a first draft, and I have to really sort of backtrack and move back through. That happened with my novel Look at Me, where I really could only use the first half. Often my clues to what needs to happen come from looking very carefully at what came first or what feels right in those early pages. Ideally, it should all be there in some sense, or there should be enough there for me to know what's coming.
Now, you say a complicated table setting, but I think the food is complicated too.
Well, that's a good point. I guess they're related because the table setting is accommodating certain, you know, if you have a soup spoon, we know we're getting some soup. And, you know, I don't want to belabor the metaphor, but I do feel like there's a kind of economy and a sort of ideally a depth so that if you do start a book over, it should read very, very differently. There should be enough texture and depth there that we can really feel the subtext of all that we now know is going to come.
Yes, well, I wanted to confess to you that when I read the whole book, I thought, how are we going to talk about this whole thing? People are always scolding you about giving things away. On the other hand, this book is about the wit of disclosure. And so I wanted to find a way to both tell and not tell at the same time, which is, I think, what you did in structuring the beginning of this novel.
I guess maybe so. I mean, somewhat unconsciously at first. But I wanted to also just say, you know, this idea of mistaken identity, which is so much fun, is something that, you know, as a literary trope, you find it in, you know, all over the place. And what I'm thinking of right now is Shakespeare. You know, even in his comedies, that, you know, very often people don't know who each other are.
Especially in his comedies.
Yes.
Yes.
But, and he plays with gender. You know, you have boys falling in love with boys, but of course, that's not what really is happening. One of them is actually a girl, and yet boys are playing all of them, of course. You know, when I first read a lot of Shakespeare, which was probably when I was about 22, I remember just seizing upon that as the most interesting part of what he was doing. And of course, in the case of the plays, it's very strange because people put on a hat or a jacket and the idea is now, you know, their own relations don't recognize them. But I love finding ways to try to recreate that effect. It is so inherently dramatic. There's something I really can't get enough of it. I don't know whether it's the fact that my grandfather was a police detective. I love detective stories. There's something about the whole notion of being undercover that I find very exciting. But there's something deep about that for me that is really just very attractive.
It's like finding new little clues with each reading. And I think for that reason, the idea that this is a historical novel, yes, it is. Of course, it is. But it's also, there aren't very many historical noir novels where the revelations depend upon history. And not only that, you see, when you close this book, what we know about the world, what we know about America since this time, rushes in. So this book is like an introduction to the America we know. And it's, as a result, a very profound and rich book that you're reading, because by the end of the book, you're in the future, and it hardly needs to be described. We just say, oh, how did she get me there?
That's really nice to hear, because when I was working on it, I thought maybe I would use some of the techniques that I had used in A Visit from the Goon Squad and leap forward and somehow link up literally with our present day reality. And that was just a disaster every time I tried it. It was so unsatisfying. It was not, we did not want to be pulled out of the moment. And what I came to feel was, I don't need to do any of that. I mean, my readers and I are here. We all know where we are. We're reading this. We're taking an imaginary trip together with our eyes wide open. So I don't need to remind people of that. We can just know it, that our reality floats there, maybe in an almost allegorical way. And that will be enough. So I'm very happy to hear that, because that was a disappointment to me as I was working. But in the end, I found that it was actually a relief to leave some of those kind of tricky narrative techniques behind on this one.
I've been talking with Jennifer Egan, author most recently of Manhattan Beach, published by Scribner. Thank you, Jennifer, for joining me.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Manhattan Beach at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from wherever you get your podcasts. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, Sean Sullivan. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Charmaine Craig is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.